Welcome to the Left the Boom Show, your go-to space for transforming businesses into extraordinary, thriving workplaces. Hosts Phil Wilson and Michael Vandervoort share learnings and tips to empower leaders and HR professionals with insights, advice, and stories from top leadership, labor relations, and labor law experts.
Today, we're going to talk about workplace disengagement, employee burnout, and mental health, and some Broadway musical recommendations. And given that we have an expert in coming in as our guest, we might even go off Broadway. So our guest today is Mary Faulkner. Mary's a talent strategist and business leader with 20 years of experience helping organizations achieve their goals. After working on the operations side of startups and small companies, Mary is now a principal with IA, which is an advisory firm that helps guide organizations through business transformation. Mary, great to have you on the Left the Boom Show. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm great. How are you two doing today?
We're good. Doing welcome, great. Mary. So Phil's yeah. A little under the weather, but soldiering on. So
yes, that's why we're broadcasting from, you know, like I look like I'm in a hostage situation here, but I'm just at home.
Got dogs locked out. They could come in at any moment and cause havoc. So anyway, we're gonna talk about a couple of different topics. The first one we're gonna jump into though is a more of a personal question for Mary, and that is, Mary, who is somebody that you believed in early on, and how did they inspire you to help you become who you are today?
Yeah. So this is an interesting question because it depends on almost what part of life you're in some ways, but there's two key people. So one is my first supervisor at Dish Network, where I worked and was kind of my first adult job is how I joke about it. So I had worked in startups and that sort of thing beforehand. Her name was Stephanie Sigler, and I'm still good friends with her today. And she cared enough to give me hard feedback is how I would put it. So I'd always been kind of an overachiever and that sort of thing, but she was really good about saying, listen, we get that you have opinions, but you need to tamp it down, or you need to figure out how to read the room and that sort of thing. So Stephanie has always been sort of my, the person who tells me when you're getting overboard type of thing. Mm-hmm. The person I would highlight is Jennifer McClure. So, and Mike knows Jen. So Jennifer and I worked at a company together, and she's the one who's like, you really should be writing a blog, or you should be tweeting, or you should get on social media and that sort of thing. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to do any of those things. But well, she didn't make me, but I credit her with that. And she's the reason why I have an opportunity to just talk with all these wonderful people and why I'm in my role today. So thank you, Jennifer.
I didn't realize you guys worked together. I never knew that.
Yeah, we were at a company. I was working at a company, and Jen was brought in as she hates it when people call her Jen too. So sorry, Jennifer was brought in as a consultant because the CHRO was gone, and so she was brought in, and she had worked with the CEO in the past. So we had a chance to work together for maybe a year or so, and she took me to my first conference and all that sort of fun stuff. So, and that's how I met everybody else.
Yeah, and it was a big change. Phil, did you?
It's funny, like a big misconception, Michael, that you hear about this when we teach approachable leadership is this whole thing about leaders, I have to be liked, I have to be like friends with the people that I lead, and they'll sometimes push back around. Well, does being approachable mean like I can't be tough? Because sometimes I need to give blunt feedback. And I think it's really interesting, the people that often stand out to us in our lives are those people that are like, hey, you're better than this. You can do more than you're doing. And a lot of times they catch us at times in our life where, we need to hear, that's the spark that we need to kind of move on to the next thing. Or so I think it's interesting. You kind of pick two people that, that did that, right? That were kind of like, hey, either give you the rough feedback about, read the room and things like that, or just like, hey, why aren't you doing this thing? I think you'd be awesome at it.
Yep.
Yeah. You mentioned being friends. When I first started in HR, I had two mistaken assumptions. One was that HR should be like the therapist for every employee who walked in the door for an issue. And so I spent hours listening to people. And it was like, you know, I was like, what am I doing in this profession? And the other one was I had a hard and fast personal rule that I wouldn't be friends with anybody at work because I might have to fire them someday, right? And it sucked. It was really hard not to be friends. I mean, you wanted to be, but I couldn't break my own rule, right? It took me about 5 years to figure out, which is a long time, and wasn't a great start to that, you know, early part of HR career where everybody thought I was kind of standoffish and that sort of thing. And I had to learn to get over my own self a little bit to, you know, and I was helped by a couple people who said, I don't know what's wrong with you. Why are you, you know, why don't you have that? Anyway, finally realized that was not the case. And my last 30 years have been a lot better and fun as a result. So cool. So Mary, we know you a little, I know you well, Phil knows you a little bit. But let's talk about Mary Faulkner and IAA. So tell us what you're doing these days and what you guys do at IAA.
Yeah. So it's funny. You were going to say AI. We run into that all the time.
Sorry. Nope.
You like to joke that AI, we were cool before AI was cool, but that's fine. But yeah, so IAA is an advisory firm. We're pretty small, but we handle clients from anywhere from 500 to 500,000, and we are in the people transformation business. So we help organizations really think through some pretty big scale transformations, whether it's their operating model, thinking through their business processes and making them better. We help with selections around different software solutions or services. But what we really kind of do on the back end is we're the glue that kind of keeps the project going, and we really help coach the people that we work with. And so while we're transforming the business, we also like to think that we're kind of transforming the people that we work with as well. We really kind of started, so Mark Stelzner is the founder and one of the managing principals, and you probably heard Mark's name. And he started it because he hates the RFP process and thought there would be a better way, and we completely agree. We always tell providers that we absolutely hate it too. So we're trying to make it better every time we deal with it.
We hate it as well.
Oh, it's awful, isn't it? I mean, it's necessary. It's a necessary evil. You need to get through and really dig into what's happening. But we really focus on use cases. So how does the software or how does the solution help us do what we need it to do, as opposed to just give me a workbook that says you can do X, Y, and Z. So we really try to make it a little bit more interactive. It's still painful, and we do our best to make it a good experience.
I don't know if you've had this experience, but like one of the reasons I hate RFPs is a lot of times like the people that are running the RFP process really have no idea what it is they're actually like asking about, and they're trying to make like a really good like purchasing decision without really knowing what it is that even that like their own internal client needs. A lot of times the internal client doesn't even really know for sure what they need. And so you end up spinning all these wheels to answer a bunch of questions that honestly, like what you should start with is, do you even really need what you're asking about? And is there a better way to do what you're asking about? And we don't always get a chance to know that until, you know, you kind of have to decide whether or not you're going to participate in the RFP. We really now turn down like most opportunities to do it just because it's kind of not worth the time.
Yeah, I love that you pointed that out, because our point of view is that you have to know yourself as an organization before you go out and try to do all these things. So we do work with a number of clients who contact us to say, oh, hey, we've been looking at some software and we see that you do selections. Can you help us? And we will take a step back and say, well, let's look at your current state. What's happening today? Do you have an incumbent? Why are you trying to leave? Right. You know, we really try to get them to the point where they truly understand what it is that they want to do. They need to have a point of view when they go into the RFP process, because when the provider is there and they're telling them, well, here's our business process and here's our library and we can implement you in 3 months, they need to understand to say, well, no, we have this future state that we've designed that we really want it to do this. How can you help us do that? Because we're process first and tech enabled. Mm-hmm. And so we really want you to be thinking through what is it that you need to do as a business, and don't be dictated. Now, will there be things that you want to do that no software can do? Absolutely. But we really want people to be thinking through what is it that's the right thing for their business and who they are. That's why we're not huge on benchmarks either. I mean, the library is a good place to start from, but every business is a little bit different and every business needs to understand what some of their tweaks are. And we, you know, we've worked with organizations that we're like, you know, ideally you would not have 10 different approval levels for one title, but that's who they are. And they're like, we're never going to change it. We understand what the pros and cons are, and this is where we're going. Well, there is not a single provider in the world that's going to be like, oh yes, we fully accommodate automation for 10 different approval positions. So you just have to know who you are and get into it. And we really, I mean, a big thing that we do that is why we love what we do, all of us do, is we get to know the client really, really well. I mean, we have people that we worked with, well, not me personally, because I've only been with IA for 5 years, but we have, you know, Kimberly's been with IA for 10 plus, and she has people that she still talks to that she worked with on her very first engagement. And it's because we care. You know, we really get to know the people. We do a lot of times act as that sort of behind the scenes therapist of and coach of being, of saying, okay, here's what we're seeing in the organization. How can we help you be successful? And it's really, we stand next to you or behind you, and we'll never stand in front of you. We are not the, here's our process, do what we say, because we're the consultant people. We are the people who want to enable you to be successful, and then we go away. We think it's really important that you be able to take it over on your own.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like we share a lot of organizational core values, actually, without getting into stating those. You know, it's funny, Mary, Phil, I was a client of LRI, or at a previous employer, and like, I don't know, 10 or 11 years ago, we were trying to buy a product that they were selling us. And because of the purchasing protocols that we followed at the company, I sent Phil like an 110-page purchasing document where he basically signed over his life and his house. And he was like, yeah, I can't sign this. And I was like, sorry, that's what they gave me. And they said, well, I can't sign it. So I called our purchasing department at that company, and they said, oh, you need the short form. Then they sent me like a one-page form, right? It was like, we just sent out the big one initially because it was the standard document, right? It's the point is, you know, a lot of, to your point, they're trying to make good decisions. They're also trying to get as much control as they can. You know?
I've had that conversation with a lot of clients. And
yeah.
I mean, it's, and the person who's purchasing, you know, the actual buyer is not the one who's like, oh, I can't wait to send you this 100-page document. But, you know, the purchasing folks send it over. And what I found over the years is first of all, it's just like, look, life is too short. And I'm a lawyer, but I'm just not reading this. So I'll give it back to you. And if that means we can't do business together, I'm sorry. But like, this document does not apply in any way to what we're actually doing.
Yeah.
And then what I found is, you know, the example Michael used, like that's generally what happens is they go, oh, okay, they're not going to sign our document. So then like, what will you sign? And then we send over, you know, a 2 or 3 page statement of work and they might add a paragraph or two to it, but it's like, okay, well, that's fine.
Yep.
So anyway.
All right. Well, let's pivot. That was not completely on the agenda, but it was interesting dialogue. But let's touch on a couple of actual HR related things. So one of the first topics I wanted to kind of tee up with you, Mary, I know you have done a presentation that you've done in the past about disengagement and how it happens. And the Gallup survey poll, you know, says that, I don't know, 33 or 32% of people, only 32 or 33% of employees are actually engaged. Phil can probably tell that. And more detail than I can. Younger workers are seeing a drop in engagement. So let's talk about how employees become disengaged. What happens?
Yeah, so the funny thing is, I'm starting to feel like engagement's not a real metric. It's just not. Even Gallup with their 12, you have to have 12 different questions that somehow magically correlate together to create this one metric to tell you how engaged you are. And it hasn't changed in 30 years. So I do wonder, it's like, is it even a thing anymore? But you definitely can tell when a worker is connected to what they're doing and what's causing them to be disconnected. And it's a lot of different things. I think it's a combination of, is the work that they're doing valued? So it used to be, is the work meaningful? And, you know, not everybody's job is going to be life-changing, but if it's something that people are going to use, people just naturally hate unnecessary work. So if you're going to give them a bunch of busy work, so like, please fill out this status report that no one's ever going to look at, but at least we have a documentation of it. That's going to cause them to get disengaged from their work. If they're not connected with their manager in some way, or leadership, So maybe it's not your direct manager, but then maybe somebody up the chain around. Do you feel like they are aware of you and care about you as a person and what's going on at both at work and somewhat at home? You know, I don't know that you always need to bring everything that's at home to work, but it absolutely impacts you. When you think about, you know, people who are going through major life changes or there's health problems or whatever it is, that impacts your ability to be engaged at work too. I mean, you're showing up to work, you're doing your job, but I got to tell you, I'll just use a personal example. When I was packing up my mother-in-law's house for her to come move in with us and we had to sell two houses and move, I was not the most connected person at work every single day because I had so many things going on. I love my job. I love the people I work with. And yet there was enough going on that I was just like, I can't give my full self to my job today. And it's just the reality of how things happen. So I think there's this combination of elements of, you know, what is the work that I'm doing? Am I valued? And you brought up younger workers. I think there's this element too of like, what's the ethics of what I'm doing? Is the company that I'm working for behaving in a way that I'm proud of? Mm-hmm. Now, I say that because there will always be people who are unethical, who find unethical companies that they align with. And that causes engagement too. I mean, I've worked for some in the past where there's some really sketchy things going on, but if people align with the values of that organization, they're going to be engaged because they get to do the things that they always wanted to do. So I just
they're
think
super people, engaged drug dealers and mobsters.
Absolutely. Right? Like,
but is that because of fear of death or because of that?
Yeah. But I mean, that really, I, you know, when I used to talk about culture and I worked with a VP once who said you're never going to align 100% with an organization, but you want to align enough that it's not a deal breaker for you. Mm-hmm. So out of it that way. And a strong culture comes from alignment, and that alignment can be is on a scale of, you know, mm-hmm. chaotic good to unlawful, whatever. So that type of stuff happens.
I'm curious, the way I've talked about this for a while is that, like, you don't measure engagement by like happiness or do I have a friend at work or like a lot of the Q12 type measures. I mean, I understand like they probably, if you're engaged, you also probably agree with those statements, but like those statements don't define whether or not you're engaged. Like the way you tell whether someone's engaged is by watching their behavior. Like, do they go above and beyond at work? Do they help each other out? Are they like looking for extra stuff to do? Like, that's someone who is like, the engagement is a verb, right? I'm just curious, like, what do you think about that?
So it's interesting. I, you know, above and beyond has always been the big thing of like, if they're looking for extra work, I think we're seeing a shift in that. I think we as business leaders need to be okay with somebody doing their job. Mm-hmm. They're doing their job well. They're doing what is expected of their job. They're not complaining about it, or maybe they complain about it and they bring forward solutions. But just because someone isn't constantly saying, hey, give me another 10 hours of work to do this week because I'm bored, doesn't mean they're not engaged. So I think there's an element of, I mean, I think this naturally happens of saying, oh, how can I help? You know, there's that how can I help element of it.
I think I said that wrong. It's like, because I totally agree with that part. Like that, like there's no question. We have way kind of oversold on, you know, you need to be working, you know, hide how much you're working so that you like, you don't get in trouble for working on the weekends or on your vacation or like, that's ridiculous. More like I'm talking a little bit more around things like, hey, I thought of this new way to do this work that I'm doing better, faster, you know, things like that where I'm showing that I'm engaged with the actual thing I'm asked to do. And I do it well. And I try to help do it better. To me, that's like more behavior. Like that's behavior of engagement.
Yeah. I think I would agree with you on that. It's that element of you've kind of internalized the work that you do. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily your full identity or anything like that, but you value it enough to be like, oh, I can take it to the next level by kind of offering to help or or finding new ways to do things and mm-hmm. and just, and doing it well. And I'm really glad you said no, happiness shouldn't be a measure of it, because I remember one place I worked, we did like a satisfaction survey. Mm-hmm. Can be satisfied with yeah. their job. You know, they're making good money, they've got a good benefit package, they might have a pension, whatever it might be, doesn't mean they're engaged.
Right.
They're showing up, maybe. But, you know, so I mean, I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, satisfied is actually in a lot of ways disengaged. Like you're like, I'm good. I'm not striving. I don't, you know, I'm probably not even really thriving. Like I'm good. I don't have any like special needs. Whereas mm-hmm. an engaged, you know, I used to talk about this a fair amount too. It's like a lot of times I tell a story about like the worst day of my marriage, which was in this adventure race that I like stupidly agreed to do with my wife. Which I was super, super unhappy that day, but I was engaged like crazy. Like I wanted to finish that race because my dignity meter was like down to zero. So happiness and engagement are like totally separate ends of the spectrum, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I think that's a really interesting way to look at it of, does engagement require a level of hunger?
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah.
It's an interesting question. I don't know. I've not thought of it that way. Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen the new Hunger Games prequel yet, or I would riff on that, but I didn't even know it was out until.
My daughter saw it. She said it was awesome, but it was like a death march. It's, I think, 3.5 hours long. She's like, every plot point was necessary. So like, I don't think they could have made it shorter, but it was long.
Okay. So, just PSA, stop with the 3.5 hour movies.
No, what is right.
Listen, I'm a moviegoer. I do not want to sit through 3.5 hours. Split it up.
I'd rather watch two movies. Yeah.
I was so happy that The Marvels was like 1 hour and 54
yes!
minutes.
That I would have loved that movie
regardless of what else it contained. So.
It was so refreshing.
And it was actually a pretty good movie too.
It was fun. Yeah, I liked it.
I liked it as well. So yeah, 3.5 hour movies are a trendy thing. I want to pivot to an example of, I don't know if this was really engagement or not, but it's one of the most bizarre situations that I've watched in a long time. And that is what happened like a week and a half ago at OpenAI when they fired their CEO, Sam Altman. Mm. The board melted down, everybody, you know, and something like, I don't know, 745 out of 770 employees, including some of the board members who actually voted to fire the guy, signed a letter that said, we're all going to quit en masse and leave the company and go to work at Microsoft unless you return Sam Altman, which ultimately happened. We won't get into all the details of that. It's just, that's a Harvard case study for the centuries probably. But was that engagement when so many people, or is it a cult? I don't know how to read that at all.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking about that a lot because I think it's, you know, obviously I don't work there, so I couldn't tell you what the day to day is like, what they feel like. But if you look at the history.
Sorry.
What's going on? A little dance break.
I had it off.
But when you look at the history of startups, and really OpenAI is a startup in a lot of different ways, and you had a board that was formed for the nonprofit arm of it, managing the profit arm. So there's that piece of it. So that's a whole thing for the Harvard case study. Mm-hmm. But when I think about it, and you look at Theranos, look at WeWork, look at some of the other startups that kind of exploded and people were all in, and even HubSpot was like this, and really being excited and believing in the mission. But then you had some leadership that, you know, people believed in, and then it turned out there was something hinky going on in the back end, which I'm not saying Sam Altman has anything hinky, but in retrospect, we look back at like a Theranos and be like, how did you not know there was something crazy? And they were so all in. And that all in piece of it, I think it's because it's something new and exciting. It's something that gives a lot of people a chance to kind of flex in a new space. So when you think about OpenAI, it's like, hey, you've got talent. We want to give you space to explore it. And I think there's that element with any startup of you're at the beginning. Might there be people who are there like, ooh, I might get options in the future? Maybe. But I think it's really about you're in on something unique and you're belonging in this very special brand new space that no one else gets to be a part of. So when somebody comes by and says, we're going to change that and make it more traditional, that makes people angry. And that makes people feel like you're telling me that what I'm doing is not special too, or you're saying what I'm doing is wrong. So I think there's that element of protectiveness of like, this is cool, this is fun, I want to be a part of it. So stop messing with us, we'll be fine. Because I mean, I watched the documentary of WeWork fairly recently, and I was just like, of course this wasn't going to be successful. It's just real estate. It's just subleasing. But they were so bought in to the idea of it. And I think that's a little bit of what you saw with OpenAI. I mean, AI is really exciting. I mean, it's scary in some respects, but it's also really exciting. So when you get a lot of really talented people working on an exciting new element, they are going to rebel if you tell them you got to go back to doing it a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That, I mean, there, I think the Harvard case study is going to be all about like the way that that, you know, that it just, the whole thing morphed, right? Like the board had kind of that's, I mean, look, when a board of directors goes, it's okay. Like killing the golden goose is like is a possible way that we can fulfill our mission as a board. Like that tells you kind of like everything that you need to know about that. Like that, you know, the people that were signed on to kind of do this were not on that same wavelength, and the board and Altman wasn't either. And then at that point that I understand, like the board, if a majority of the board is like, yes, this is, you know, we need to stop this now. And everyone else is like not on board, then yeah, you're going to have like a total mutiny, which is what they had. And then unfortunately, like, you know, the companies now, you know, this is a multi, you know, $1 billion company, that sort of just like exploded on the scene in months, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole lot of value. I'll tell, like the people that were really, you know, probably choking were, you know, were all these banks, and, you know, Microsoft was going to end up fine, but like everybody else that was still holding the bag on OpenAI was, you know, I'm sure we're having a very hard time sleeping over that weekend.
Oh, I'm sure. It was so crazy. Like every day, I was like, oh, what else has happened today? But one thing I wanted to kind of point out when you're talking about, I think a big aspect of it was the lack of transparency. So even the CEO said, I'm going to quit unless you tell me why this happened. Mm-hmm. And it's that idea of governance. When you have a technology moving this fast with so much potential for bias. I mean, United Healthcare just got sued because they said 90% of their claims just got rejected by AI. That's a concern about bias, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that the board was acting out of malice. I think there was concerns about how quickly the technology was moving, and they didn't feel like there was proper governance and stage gates in place. Put those in place. Mm-hmm. If you're worried about it, put those in place before you get to the point where you feel like you have to fire this guy that everybody loves. So it's everything, but I think transparency ties back to what employees want. You know, maybe Altman's like a super transparent CEO that's really approachable, and everybody felt like they were a part of his team. And yet you had this board who in a black box just one day decided to do this. We don't know why they did this. They still haven't really said why they did this. Mm-hmm. There was chatter about, well, he was raising money in the Middle East to start his own company. We don't know if that's true. There was chatter that they were worried that AI was moving too quickly. We don't know if that's true because they haven't said. Mm-hmm. So I think there's that element of transparency of people just want to understand what their leadership is doing and why.
And I think to boil that down to just, you know, like frontline supervisors in any organization, it's the same thing, right? It's like, are you transparent? You may not have all the answers. You may not even really understand like why a decision was made. But if you are able to kind of explain like here's what I've done to try to figure it out. Here's what I can tell you that like I will commit to do that I have control over. But that like, that's what employees need to hear and need to understand. And that can be true for an entire organization. That can be true for a department. It's still the same basic tasks, right? It's like, tell me what's going on based on whatever information that you have right now. If you feel like you don't have the information, tell me that too. You know, it's not complicated.
Yeah. I mean, people have a pretty strong BS detector. They'll know if you're making it up. Mm-hmm. So it's, you just need to be honest with people.
Yeah.
So we have a couple more quick sections to cover. So that example we just looked at is kind of like Silicon Valley hustle culture on steroids or something. I don't know, but you wanted to talk, I think, for a minute, Mary, about burnout, mental health at work and kind of some of that kind of stuff. So what, it's pretty obvious. I had the question stated as, is burnout on the rise? I think it's pretty obvious that it is. I think we've all been affected by the pandemic and work and uncertainty and return to office and all the things that are out there. So what's the main cause, and what can, you know, to kind of go back to what Phil just said, what can first line supervisors do to help with this kind of, with this environment that we're operating in?
I wish I could find the article again. I read this great article that said, why are we still like this? Why is burnout continuing to spiral, even though there's a little bit more stability, not for some people. I mean, there's been a lot of layoffs and reorgs and that sort of thing going on, but you know, we're a few years out, and what's going on. And a big part of it is just saying we're still in protection react mode. We just don't know when the next shoe is going to drop. So we didn't get a chance as a society to collectively take our breath and say, mm-hmm. okay, what's next? You know, it's sort of, we've been through this. There wasn't a beginning. There was a beginning and a middle, but the ending is iffy. It's not really an ending. And so you've got a spectrum of people who are like, it's nothing. It's just, it's a cold. And then the spectrum of people like, I mask and wash and act like it's day one because I just don't know what's going to happen. And so I think there's just collectively, people just don't know how to get back to non-reactive mode. And we're bringing that into the workspace. So, you know, work has changed. There's different values. We've all decided whether or not, you know, I think you could say engagement, for however it's been defined, has gone down because people have reprioritized work. They've said, you know what? Mm-hmm. It is a thing I do. It helps me sustain my life and everything, but it's not my number one thing anymore. I want to spend time with my family, spend time with my dog, travel, whatever it might be. So there's still so much flux, and you've got this, the other piece of it too, is that there's this tension between the old school, like we just want to get it back to what we were. We have commercial real estate that we've been renting and we need people back there. It's easier for us to lead you. It's, you know, we can control you this way. And then you've got all these workers who are like, yeah, there's a better way to do this. And I am not leaving frontline workers out of this by any means. They're the ones who were dealing with the brunt of it because they had to go into the stores and work in the stores or be public facing or whatever it might be. So they had all this fear this whole time. And here we are talking about, oh, return to the office and it's so unfair. And they're like, we have been there since day one and no one's recognizing that. So there's all this tension going on. And yet we're supposed to be constantly creating and constantly doing that. And we've not given people in general the space to just almost like grieve what society was, grieve what we might have lost during the pandemic, or just reset. And we're just like, go, 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 go. Now it's back. Let's go. Because yeah, maybe we were slower during the pandemic, but we weren't relaxed because we didn't know what was going to happen next. So from a supervisor and a leadership perspective, I think what you can do to help is just really acknowledge that and find out, like, even do check yourself. How are you feeling? How are you adjusting to what the new world is? Do you need help? Do you need to figure out a better way to supervise people if you're no longer in the same building with them? It's asking for help and just acknowledging that you yourself as a leader don't feel 100% every day either. And it makes the space for your people to have that same reaction. And I think if you just start having more conversations about it, it can help a lot.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And for the leaders to be like on the lookout for it, right? It's not all work, right? You need to be concerned about the whole person who's on your team. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, Mary, that the, you know, like when you were moving your mother-in-law, right? There's going to be seasons in life and there's going to be periods where someone is not going to be like fully engaged at work, however you define that, or, you know, going to be going through something and like being, you know, being on the lookout for that. I do think it's talked about a lot more now, and it's safe to talk about it now in a way that it really never has been before. So I think that's progress, but you still have to talk about it, you know, when it's happening.
Well, or give people time off. I mean, I hate to say mm-hmm. that, but it's one thing to acknowledge it and then say, oh, I know you're really burned out right now. And oh, by the way, I need this tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
That's not a good message. So finding ways to accommodate people going through this, you know, we've worked with a number of global clients and they have a burnout leave available for their people where they're just like, I need to take 4 weeks off. Okay.
Yeah.
Go reset. And I mean, imagine if we had that, or even not 4 weeks, just like we could take a vacation without feeling like we had to check our email.
Yeah. We still struggle with parental leave and all that.
Yes.
Kind of, so,
yeah. Yeah. Lord forbid you have a baby and actually take a couple of days off to like hang out with your kid.
Yeah.
there was an interesting article that Suzanne Lucas wrote, Evil HR Lady, about that paternal leave. You don't really need.
Yes.
She was like, I didn't really need my husband hanging around with me for 12 weeks while he drew pay, right? We didn't both need to look at the baby all day long. It would have been great if he could have taken days off intermittently.
Yes.
Like when I needed to get a break, or, you know, so, right. So it's not even just the leave. It's like how it works and how you apply it. Other things, I think. I thought that was pretty interesting, kind of subtle observation. We still have a long way to go on that, I think.
Well, so. I mean, even think about bereavement leave in terms of, like 3 days right after it happens and you have to prove that's when it happened. Those are your dates. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, for most people, I mean, if you think about it, yeah, there's stuff that you do the first couple of days. It's really like a couple of weeks later that you really need the time, or if you're traveling, you really need that time, or, you know, maybe in 3 months when you're trying to close out the estate and you need that time. I mean, we just need to be, I think the flexibility is growing, to your point, Phil, around people really understanding that this impacts how people work and how they show up at work. So let's figure out a way to make it more meaningful. But there, again, we're back at that tension between the old ways and the new ways. And it's sort of that death throes of like, well, I want it to be this way still. And it's like, well, I don't know that's going to happen going forward.
Yeah.
All right. So let's wrap up with our fun section, which is going to rely, at least from my perspective, I have no idea what Phil's knowledge level is on the topic we're about to jump into, but I know, Mary, that you love musicals. So tell us three musicals or plays that people should see going into 2024.
Okay, I actually came up with four, so I apologize.
All right. That's the bonus point.
Right. So a couple of them have been around for a while, and a couple of them are a little bit newer. But if you haven't seen Hadestown. Hadestown. I mean, Hamilton's a given, but I figure by this point, everybody's seen Hadestown, it or watched it.
I have not. I would love to, but I have not.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Hadestown is beautiful. It's just beautifully written. It's a great album. It's a beautiful production. I saw the touring on tour, so because Denver has a really great tour. So Hadestown. I would say Six is great. We're going to see that on tour here in December, but the music's fantastic and it's a quick 90 minutes, no intermission, fun kind of cabaret style. So I would say
I
Six.
I saw that in Chicago and it is, it's like very, I kind of had like a basic idea. And then, wow. Like it's very cool. It's, I'm not even going to, I won't go into it, but it's like, it's surprising. It's fun. Smart. It's cool.
And the music slams. So I'd say Six. I would say Pearlie's Victorious. I really want to see it. I haven't seen it. Leslie Odom Jr. brought it back to Broadway. I believe it is it's a revival, but it's getting amazing reviews. And the whole thing is premised on the idea that people can't tell two Black people apart. And so he uses that to his advantage to advance something. I don't remember what it was. I'm sorry. I should have read it better. But it is a musical, but it's also very play. And also it's Leslie Odom Jr., who was the original Aaron Burr. And he's just an amazing performer anyway. So I'd say Pearly Victorious. And then Spamalot is in revival. And I love Spamalot. It makes me laugh. Yep.
I somehow have never seen that. I have to go see that. And I love Monty Python.
It's really great. Like it's a wink and a nod to how ridiculous some musicals are.
Yeah.
There's a song called This Song that goes like this.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
My daughter was like, is still, but like was into theater big time in high school. And, they had kind of a cabaret where they did that song. And so that song is just fantastic.
I love it. And the key changes. Oh, it just makes sense.
Yeah, love here's those. The bridge, and here, yeah, it's like, yeah, it's really fun.
So, and then I discovered Korn, or Shucked, rather. I discovered the Korn song from Shucked by uncharacteristically watching the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and they did this performance of this song about Korn, and I was like, what? Literally, like, what the hell is that? And I posted that on Twitter, and somebody said, it's a great musical, leave it alone. And then I asked you the same question, and that was basically your response. So, even though you didn't add Shucked to your list, what is this phenomenon?
You didn't. So the thing with Shucked is that it's just, it's fun. It's one of those things of, it's a low stakes local community. They're really into Korn. It's funny. I mean, it was nominated, I think, for 9 Tonys. It won one for a featured actor. Alex Newell won. She's amazing. It's just one of those things of, it just hit right. It's kind of like, you know, Avenue Q. If you remember Avenue Q, mm-hmm. low stakes, but great fun. Like mm-hmm. it just hit the right thing. And I think it's just one of those things. It's okay to go see a musical that just makes you happy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Pretty traditional story arc. The music is fun and ridiculous. And, you know, it's just let it go. Let it be its thing.
Well, that's a great place to wrap up because we've run over as we typically do here. Our 30-minute show is 42 minutes or something like that right now. So any final thoughts? And then, Mary, if you could share where people might find you if they care to reach out and get in touch with you for some reason.
Absolutely. So you can find us on LinkedIn. Find me on LinkedIn. Our website is ia-hr.com because I guess Iowa has IA wrapped up. But ia-hr.com, and you can find all of my contact information there in the about page. I'm still on Twitter, whatever the heck it's called these days. I'm trying Threads, not really in love with it. And then definitely on LinkedIn and Instagram. So I'd love to see you there.
Phil, yeah. Any last thoughts?
Just great to get to know you better, Mary, and fun conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us on Left the Boom, and we will see you for the next show.
Yeah. Thanks. Great. Everyone. All right. I will stop the recording. But
awkward pause.
Great. We have to-